on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing this week on Japanese Americans who served our country during World War II, many doing so while their families were held in internment camps. We listened to some of Robert Yano's story. He's from Kingsburg, where he served as Grand Marshal of the famed Swedish Festival last year. But the next snippet here comes from Clarence Suzuki, who grew up a long way from Central California.
But she was bleeding, and then that was my first exposure to what happened on that day, December 7th. But the firemen told us to go home and just stay there and listen to the radio, so I went home.
Well, and for people who haven't visited Honolulu, I'm just picturing in my mind, now Pearl Harbor is a couple miles west of what you're talking about. These are the streets of Honolulu, closer to Waikiki, just north of the beaches of Waikiki. In fact, I'll never look at that intersection the same now that you've told me that story. So this is not where all the boats or anything are. This is far away from what the attacks there. Had you had any indication before that something like this could happen? How big of a shock was it?
Well, in 1940, I think my recollection may not be historically correct, but during the summer of 1941, you know, now and then we were out to Waikiki Beach. Next door was Kuhio Beach. Waikiki was for the tourists, Kuhio Beach was for the locals. But during the summer, maybe twice a week we'd be out there swimming, and I would notice that the aircraft carriers were out there on the horizon. Sometimes three, sometimes none. But my understanding in 1941 summer was the islands were on red alert already. And if you, read about December 7th, there's no acknowledgement that the islands were on red alert. But my recollection is that we were on red alert, namely because in the summer of 1940, Rear Admiral, he was one of the intelligence chiefs in Washington, but he said that Japan might attack Pearl Harbor. But in June of 1941, he says Japan is most likely to attack Pearl Harbor. So that's the kind of historic, background that I have. But most of the media never acknowledged that the islands were on red alert.
Well, I guess it probably wasn't politically expedient at the time because they wanted it to play out as a sneak attack, and that would get America together in a different way. I'm curious, as someone who was Japanese-American living on the island of Oahu, did you know immediately that it was Imperial Japan that had attacked, and did it strike you that this might be tough to be a Japanese-American on that island after the attacks?
Yes. After I saw the explosion and the fire on Macaulay and King, the firemen told us to go home, stay there. So within a couple of days, message from the authorities was to stay indoors, don't turn on the lights at night. But it turns out that everybody wondered what happened on the Macaulay and King fire, explosion and fire. As it turned out, Pearl Harbor anti-aircraft guns were shooting at the planes, and some of the shells did not detonate as they were supposed to up in the air. They came down on the ground and exploded. And the same thing was in the city of Honolulu. My understanding was about 260 civilians were killed by our own artillery fire, the bombs exploding in the city of Honolulu.
And you came, I guess, fairly close to being another one added to that tally. How far away were you from these explosions and that fire?
Oh, that fire in Macaulay, I was only about a block away, pretty close. See, because I was going to the Olivet Baptist Church for Bible training, but we had to go early and meet at my friend's house, and that was the location that was so close to the bomb. But the church was only another block, Mauka, north, where we were meeting at the Suemori's house.
So in the wake of this, I mean, and as America found out, and everyone who I've ever interviewed has a memory of how they first found out about these attacks, you found out before just about anybody because you were right there. But in the weeks and the months that followed, what was life like there? And when did you realize that your life might end up changing a little bit?
Well, we just had to stay indoors. The instructions were coming over the radio that you should, you know, dig a bomb shelter, and every home would be supplied with some lumber or whatever to make a bomb shelter. So my father and I, we had to pick and shovel in the front yard to build a bomb shelter. But it was kind of messy too, because, you know, all that, you know, dirt and stuff like that, and you had to have lumber to cover up the sort of a tunnel that you dug, just barely, you know, enough for a couple of three people. After that, you had to put the black cloth over the windows, and you couldn't have any light shining at night. But we managed. We got some black cloth and some low incandescent lamps. We managed to be in a blackout. And then the school said, yeah, we're going to be school coming out. But this was now around February of 1942. So all the kids went back to school. From that point on, I think the military was, you know, getting more and more secure about Japan not attacking and landing in the Hawaiian Islands.
And that's the thing. I don't want to look past that, because we know now that Japan didn't come back and conquer the islands as they might have been able to had they struck at the right time. But it must have been a constant state of fear for you there, having seen what they did on December 7th, that they might come back. How did you deal with that?
Well, we all worried about that, you know, that the Japan armed forces might return. But in the meantime, the military governor, General Emmons, allowed the University of Hawaii ROTC guys to form the Victory Volunteer Soldiers. And there was another group of Niseis that were already in the U.S. Army. They got booted out. And there was another group in the Territorial Guard. So these three groups formed later on the nucleus of the 100th Infantry Battalion. School started, and we tried to get back to normalcy, but things were not normal. I mean, we didn't have the regular teachers. My teacher, Dr. Daiho Chan, he was a major, and he didn't come back to school because he had a ROTC commission. And we had another teacher called Mrs. Evans. She was not up to snuff. But we managed to, you know, go through all this period. And I graduated from McKinley High School in 1943. At that time, they were asking for volunteers. And I asked my papa, and he said, no, don't go. But the others, they went, like Senator, you know, Dan Inouye. He was a year older than me. I think he was in the university already, but he volunteered. And some of my classmates volunteered also. They became the nucleus of the 442nd. And I met Senator Inouye in Washington.
At this recent Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony in November?
November 2nd, they had kind of a impromptu pre-dinner, you know, get-together. So I met Senator Inouye at the time. And I told Senator, you know, you were in McCulley and Bingham Track, and I was in McCulley down on Date Street. And he opened his eyes and said, oh, you know, he didn't say anything. I said, no, you know, Dan, you were in the Troop 36, the Boy Scouts of America, and we met at the YMCA once a month. And Dan only smiled, and, you know, he didn't say anything. And then I told Dan, hey, you know, when I went to the university after the war, his wife, Margaret Aramura, was in the teacher's department or whatever, and she was administering the English, spoken English test. So I passed, but my wife Thelma flunked. She had to go to speech lab. But I mentioned that all. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Soken, my classmate, also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys, too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
He probably got a lot of those conversations that week in Washington. But what I hear, and so you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wondered about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Skofia Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know, whatever. And she was administering the English, spoken English test. So I passed, but my wife Thelma flunked. She had to go to speech lab. But I mentioned that all. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Soken, my classmate. Also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
He probably got a lot of those conversations that week in Washington. But what I hear, and so you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wondered about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Skofia Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know. But this language school, I attended about a month, and then this Navy Lieutenant J.G. came by, and he was interviewing a lot of the guys that was in the school, and I apparently passed the language test because I was the only guy that he sent me to Tinian. The rest of them went to Okinawa. But it's because of my spoken language proficiency. Before the war, I went to 8th grade in a Japanese language school. It was for at least 1.5 hours after English school. So it was basically 3 o'clock to about 5 o'clock, plus 3 hours on Saturday morning. So I had a good command of the spoken language. But the kanji, the Chinese characters, I wasn't that good at. But the Navy was looking for people that could speak the language. See, we had to, interrogate, interpret.
And I don't want to make a leap here, but as I just think about this in retrospect and know where you did end up, and not that it was a cakewalk what you experienced, but if you didn't have those language skills, if you hadn't been that dedicated in your schoolwork and learning the Japanese language and other situations, then you might have ended up somewhere else. The language skills you had may have ended up saving your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a fair estimate, because if I didn't pass that test, I would have probably gone overseas, maybe back to Italy or someplace. Sometimes being smart, you know, might be helpful.
So you served as an interrogator and interpreter in the Pacific, places like Saipan and Tinian, where you'd even see the famed Enola Gay. But when it comes to Japanese Americans in World War II, a lot of people have heard about the 442nd, what they did in Europe. Do you ever run into people who are surprised that you served in the Pacific because they haven't heard of the MIS or didn't know that Japanese Americans were involved in that part of the war?
Yeah, most of my friends didn't know that the MIS was in the Pacific, namely because until the Freedom of Information Act 1976, most people didn't know we were out there in the Pacific, attached to the Marines, attached to the Army, attached to the Australian, British armies, Indian army. More recently, information is coming out that we were out there. We were in every major battle in the Pacific. Most Americans know the 442 served in Italy and France, but I would say only 10% of the Americans know that the Nisei were out in the Pacific in every major battle.
Well, hopefully we're helping a few more people understand that today. Well, as we wrap up the show, I just want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for sharing some of those stories with us.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you interrogating me.
The tables are turned.
Yes. Thank you so much.
That was Clarence Suzuki. You can tap into that entire interview also at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, yet another Nisei veteran we've had the privilege of listening to on Hometown Heroes as we enter a week where the internment is remembered. We'll be right back after this.